Hello, this is Daria O'Connor, and this will be the National Geographic program today. I'm reading from the August issue, and we're going to open with a story about wolverines. Happens to be something my best friend loves, so I hope she's listening. It's written by Douglas Chadwick, and it's titled The Survivors. Wolverines, the small and fierce carnivore of the far north, are battling new threats as warming shrinks their territory. One night years ago, biologist Albert Manville drove to a garbage dump near Lake Louise in Alberta's Banff National Park. The site was unfenced back then, and grizzlies often came to rummage for leftovers. Manville was watching a bear feast on a hefty scrap of meat when he noticed movement toward the edge of his car's beaming headlights. It was a wolverine staring intently at the bear and the meat. What else could it do? It weighed maybe 30 pounds. The grizzly weighed several hundred. Then all at once, the wolverine ran up and bit the bear right on the butt, Manville says. The grizzly whirled and swiped with a paw, but the wolverine was already racing around to one side. It grabbed the meat and ran off into the dark. A wolverine doesn't seem like a reasonable beast, for it acts too tough and brazen for its size. But at barely 3 feet long, from keen nose to bushy tail, an average wolverine will claim a territory of 100 to more than 500 square miles, then patrol it at an unrelenting pace, sniffing, probing, hunting, scavenging, and defending its home from rivals. In the 5 years that I volunteered with a groundbreaking study in Montana's Glacier National Park, I tracked one radio-tagged male as he climbed 1,500 feet straight up an ice-packed chute on a sheer mountainside and crossed the Continental Divide. This ascent took him less than 20 minutes. Another male scaled the park's highest summit, 10,466-foot-high Mount Cleveland, in January, when the peak was a towering ice sculpture. He covered the last 4,000 feet in 90 minutes. Within the next 10 days, he climbed other crests to the west, turned north into British Columbia, loped east across the divide and on through Wateron Lakes National Park in Alberta, and returned south across more massifs to get back to Glacier. No big deal. Within a day or two, he took off and made the journey all over again. Skunk bear, mountain devil, demon of the north. For centuries, wolverines were defined not only as greedy, god-awful smelling, and eerily wily and elusive, but also as foul-tempered, wantonly destructive, and a danger to people in the backcountry. But none of these characterizations fit. Gulo gulo, from the Latin word glutton, is native to Arctic, subarctic, and mountain regions of the Northern Hemisphere. The species is part of the large and varied mustelid family, many of which have revved up metabolisms. The group includes martens, weasels, badgers, honey badgers, otters, and sea otters. Of the group's non-aquatic members, the wolverine has the heaviest skull, thickest jaws, biggest teeth, largest body, and largest feet. A single gulo can bring down prey as large as an adult caribou, and unverified reports describe wolverines occasionally forcing wolves and even big bears away from a carcass. The last thing a wolverine is, so it would seem, is vulnerable. But trappers, hunters, livestock owners erase the animal from much of Eurasia. In the New World, government-sponsored predator eradication campaigns took a heavy toll. By the 1930s, the species had disappeared from the lower 48 states. Yet wolverines are tenacious survivors that still have strongholds in Alaska and parts of Western Canada. As predator poisoning was phased out during the 1960s, wolverines from the Canadian Rockies started to recolonize Montana's high country and spread to parts of Idaho and northern Wyoming. Then in the 1990s, wolverines from Canada began venturing into Washington's northern Cascades. Today, breeding groups live in four states, Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and Washington, but the population remains small. A recent estimate put the number of wolverines south of Canada around 300 animals. Meanwhile, populations on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border face a variety of threats. Most come from expanding human activities in the backcountry, but one concern overrides all the others, a warming climate. Gulo is specially adapted to and highly dependent on habitats with year-round cool conditions and lingering snowpack. Although polar regions are heating up faster than other latitudes, similar temperature increases are happening in the planet's high altitudes, such as the Rockies. If climate change continues as predicted, wolverines could lose one-third of their present range south of Canada by 2050, and two-thirds before the end of this century. Since 1994, despite petitions and lawsuits seeking to protect wolverines under the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has resisted listing wolverines as threatened. In 2016, citing growing threat of climate change, a federal judge ordered the agency to reconsider its decision. That's where the matter stands today, in limbo. Glacier National Park is home to the densest populations of wolverines in the contiguous U.S. But because each wolverine jealously guards a huge territory, a total of 30 to 40 is about all that will ever fit into the 1,500-square-mile park. Fact is, no single preserve holds a wolverine population large enough to be truly self-sustaining. To cope with environmental changes and avoid inbreeding over the long run, every group needs to be connected to the others within a larger region. Biologists used to say that the best plan to conserve wildlife is to set aside parks and preserves. Now they say we must also safeguard natural corridors that link these protected areas, ensuring that species such as wolverines can travel across large landscapes, exchange genes, and adjust to shifting conditions. Wolverines aren't much for theory, but they know instinctively not to do things halfway. You have to go the distance. Our next article is called The Dalai Lama's Power of Hope. 6 decades after escaping Tibet, the exiled monk is optimistic about humanity, even as his people worry about life without him. And this is written by Anne Curry. "Don't interrupt his prayers," Tibetan monks whisper before opening the wide wooden doors leading to the Dalai Lama's inner sanctuary, where he meditates 3 to 4 hours every morning before dawn. Inside the Dalai Lama's palace, in exile in Dharamsala, India, we are escorted up a set of stairs and down a corridor to his private quarters. The room is dark, the only light coming from the windows. We can see the same Himalaya mountain range he crossed from Tibet 60 years ago, when, as a young spiritual and political leader, he escaped amid suspicions that the Chinese were about to arrest him. The space is modestly furnished, except for a glass case filled with venerated Buddhist statues. On the other side of the room sits the Dalai Lama, still, silent, and cross-legged in a massive chair, a pair of red shoes left neatly on the floor. We step forward lightly to document this rare glimpse of the private world of His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, the manifestation of Buddhism's Bodhisattva of compassion. When his eyes suddenly open, "Hello, hello," he says, smiling. He beckons. According to Tibetan protocol, This is the moment when you are to put your hands together in prayer and bow your head toward him, just as he does the same toward you. Being neither Buddhist nor Tibetan, I tend to bow awkwardly, and I often lift my head too soon, just as His Holiness is leaning in to try and touch his forehead to mine, in the traditional gesture of friendship and respect. Embarrassingly, I have also, without thinking, shaken his hand and even hugged him in previous meetings through the years, to the raised eyebrows of his aides. So this time, I am determined to get it right. But as I step forward to bow, the Dalai Lama, with a twinkle in his eye, reaches to take my right hand and shakes it while slowly pulling me closer, so that our foreheads eventually touch. Then he chuckles. The Dalai Lama typically dispenses with formalities. Though he is revered by Tibetan Buddhists as a sacred being, he says, "I am a simple Buddhist monk." When you meet him, he will often do something immediately to communicate that no walls separate you from him, nor one human from another. If you are bald, he might touch the top of your head and his own shaved head in the same moment and laugh joyously. If you have a full head of hair, he might do the same to point out jokingly that you have more hair than he. Sometimes he puts his hand in yours for a bit and peers inquisitively into your eyes, a serene smile spreading across his face. He smiles a lot. It's hard for people not to smile back. Now in his 80s, the Dalai Lama speaks candidly about his past and his future in a wide-ranging interview, touching on his epic escape, his relationship with Chinese officials, his perspective on the acrimony of our times, and how he's dealing with aging, and why there is reason to hope for the future of humankind. In the 6 decades since his escape, the Dalai Lama has traveled to more than 60 countries on a quest to preserve Tibetan culture, religion, and identity. His ease at connecting with others on a human level is one reason he is deeply admired in many parts of the world, though once he was little understood outside Tibet. There, high in his kingdom on the roof of the world, Tibetans would drop to the ground at a mere glimpse of him to prostrate themselves, believing him to be the reincarnation of 13 previous Dalai Lamas in a line that dates to the 15th century. Whenever he left the Potala, his, quote, 1,000-chambered winter palace, as he would later describe it in his autobiography, the Dalai Lama was escorted by a procession of, quote, hundreds of people, including horsemen dressed in colorful traditional costumes and carrying flags, and monks holding up banners decorated with sacred texts. He was just 2 years old when a search party of high-ranking monks followed omens to his family's home in a tiny farming settlement in 1937. When shown an array of objects, they said, the child correctly picked the ones that had belonged to the previous Dalai Lama, including a walking stick and a rosary. The boy even seemed to recognize the monks, calling one by name. After passing more tests, he was taken on a 3-month journey through gargantuan mountains flanking immense flat plains to reach Tibet's capital of Lhasa, where endless crowds welcomed him before he was formally installed on the vast jewel-encrusted lion throne as the spiritual leader of Tibet. He was 4 years old. His destiny was changed by Mao Zedong, whose forces invaded Tibet in 1950, a year after leading the communist revolution that founded the People's Republic of China. Tibet was unprepared to defend itself against the tens of thousands of Chinese troops moving toward Lhasa. The Tibetan government took the Dalai Lama out of the city for refuge, but he worried about what would happen to his people and decided to return, hoping to negotiate a peace. The Dalai Lama was 19 when he met face-to-face with Chairman Mao in Beijing. Now, decades later, he says that after their encounters, Mao seemed to soften his manner toward him and even surprised him with what seemed generous advice about how to be a good leader to his people. By the time he returned to Lhasa, he said, he actually felt, quote, full of trust, confidence, and hope that peace was possible. But Tibetans were chafing under China's control. According to a 1960 International Commission of Jurists report submitted to the United Nations, quote, torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment were inflicted on the Tibetans on a large scale, end quote. The report also found that the old culture of Tibet, including its religion, was attacked in an attempt to eradicate it. As Tibetans rose up in a series of revolts, Chinese authorities began arresting high lamas and officials. By March 10th in 1959, thousands of Tibetans, afraid the Dalai Lama would also be seized, surrounded him in his summer palace in Lhasa and formed a massive human shield to protect him. They also refused to disperse. Quote, I tried my best to cool down the situation, the Dalai Lama recalls, which became more and more tense. The Chinese sent a message saying they would move in to protect the palace, but he said there was doubt whether they intended to protect it or make it a target. Mortar shells landed near the palace complex. So on March 17th, he decided there was, quote, no other alternative except escape, end quote. Disguised in soldier's clothes, with a long black coat and a rifle slung over his right shoulder, the Dalai Lama slipped out of the palace on foot that very night, not knowing whether he would live to see another day. So began an epic escape over the snowy Himalaya that the world at first didn't even know was happening. It wasn't until he had crossed the 15,000-foot pass outside Lhasa in a small caravan that included his mother that Chinese official realized he had left the city. They closed border crossing and rushed troops to chase him down. A Chinese patrol had nearly caught him the night he left as he crossed the Lhasa River. The Dalai Lama's eyes widened slightly as he recounts that moment. The People's Liberation Army was just on the other side of the river, so close to the guards that, quote, we could talk, he says. That time winter, so the river low, very, very serious danger. Somehow we escaped, we survived, end quote. After 14 days of struggling against blizzards and then torrential rains and fighting fear and fatigue, the Dalai Lama crossed into India on March 31st, 1959, to freedom, as he puts it. At 23 years of age, he was welcomed as a refugee by Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru and began a life in exile. But the tragedy was just beginning. In Lhasa, some 2 days after his escape, Chinese troops shelled his summer palace and machine-gunned the crowd of thousands. Quote, by 1976, Tibet's cultural and religious heritage, including almost all its monasteries, lay in ruins, end quote, the International Commission of Jurists reported in 1997. It continued, tens if not hundreds of thousands of Tibetans were killed. Buddhist scriptures were burned, murals defaced, Chinese immigration to Tibet rose dramatically, the commission said. Most of Tibet's wildlife and much of its forested land had been destroyed. Eventually, the Tibetan language would come under threat, and anyone caught with a photo of the Dalai Lama could be arrested. All this has contributed to such a state of despair in Tibet that a wave of self-immolations began in 2011, with more than 150 monks, nuns, and other Tibetans reportedly setting themselves on fire in protest. Eliminating what makes Tibet distinct is totally wrong, the Dalai Lama says, raising his voice. They cannot do that. They must respect Tibetan culture. He adds that China's own archaeologists have found evidence that humans have lived on the Tibetan plateau since the Stone Age. despite the pain of watching from afar what has happened to Tibet, he has consistently refused to encourage violence. Asked how it is possible for him not to react with anger and bitterness, he explains that Tibetan monks are, quote, trained according to Nalanda tradition, and we become more realistic. Entire human beings are our brothers and sisters. End quote. As the Dalai Lama crisscrossed the globe in search of a diplomatic solution, he repeatedly appealed to the UN. He unveiled a peace plan in Washington, D.C. in 1987 and addressed the European Parliament in 1988. He has met one-on-one with world leaders, including U.S. presidents and members of Congress, and Pope John Paul II on behalf of the Tibetan people. In one of his overtures to China, he proposed, quote, the middle way, renouncing the dream of Tibet's independence in favor of mutually beneficial autonomy that would preserve Tibetan culture. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989, but he hasn't been able to protect Tibet. When asked whether the middle way approach was a mistake, the Dalai Lama says he thinks it still might work. China's current president, Xi Jinping, he says, has shown courage in dealing with corruption in his country and espousing new thinking after 70 years of hardliner policy. We'll see. Next one year, 2 years, I think something may change, he said. The Dalai Lama says he even has hope that President Xi could allow him to make a pilgrimage in China to see the sacred Buddhist site called Wu Tai Shan, calling it a, quote, special blessing that he's dreamed of for more than six decades. After all these years, the Dalai Lama still pines for the world he left behind, though he believes that if he hadn't left it, Tibet's ancient Buddhist traditions would not have survived. He has worked to spread the wisdom of those traditions to audiences worldwide, sharing knowledge about how humans can feel happier and suffer less. He often talks about the connection between Buddhism and modern science, citing evidence from both that compassion is good for your brain. Today, the Tibetan spirit is not dying, he says. Tibetan spirit is very strong. And he says that while he lost one small home, he found big home. Asked what big home, he says, the whole world. But it is a world that may begin to see less of him. His body is not letting him keep the same pace. I think the feeling of tiredness increasing. That's quite understandable because of the age, he says. He'll fly less often to avoid the 15-hour-plus flights across 10 time zones to the U.S., acknowledging that it's too far, now quite difficult. His knees bother him when he's climbing or descending. Last year's appearances in North America were canceled, but he did fly to Europe, a trip that is comparatively okay, he said. His posted 2019 schedule has him remaining close to home in India. He was treated for prostate cancer a few years ago, and now he has a clean bill of health from his doctors. He looks and sounds much younger than his age. Even so, his aides are limiting his daily schedule. Audiences with dignitaries and others, which used to last until late as 5 in the afternoon, now are scheduled to end before lunch, though he tends to push to work longer than his aides think he should. On some days, as many as 1,000 people from around the world line up, waiting to see him. He walks down a sloping path, his long maroon and mustard robes wafting lightly in the breeze, toward the low murmur of the crowd. When he sees the line of people, he stops and waves, breaking into a warm smile and then gingerly making his way up several stairs to the wide wooden chair where he sits to greet them one by one. A baby with a disability is carried up the stairs by a mother who bursts into tears. A group of monks bow in respect and ask for guidance. Middle-aged woman asks him to give her a healing blessing by blowing a breath into her mouth. He complies. An elderly man rocking forward on crutches tells him about his physical pains. We are all born to die, the Dalai Lama says. Some Tibetans worry about what will happen to their people, both the more than 100,000 outside Tibet and the estimated 6 million still in Tibet when the Dalai Lama dies. At a small weekly dinner in Dharamsala, sometimes called Little Lhasa, a group of poets, researchers, artists, Tibetan politicians, and activists openly discuss that eventuality. Sitting under posters of Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., Tenzin Sundu speaks first, saying, "We are his children. No community has had such a leader." But, he adds, "This is a freedom struggle. We have to do more. Now it's our time to dance." Still, they aren't quite sure what to do, and they debate whether the Dalai Lama's middle way approach will be enough. One politician questions whether, after all China has done to Tibet, they could even adhere to the Dalai Lama's position of nonviolence. At Namgyal Monastery, the personal monastery of the Dalai Lama, Abbot Thamthong Rinpoche turns solemn considering the question. Quote, "When His Holiness passes, it will be a disaster. There are no leaders like him." The Dalai Lama is the pillar, explains the monastery's headmaster, Kunga Gyatso. "The Buddha is still alive with his teaching. Right now we stand together. Our concern is whether we can stand together as we have until now," he adds. "The Dalai Lama doesn't need to come back, but if the people need him, they will find him. In 5 or 10 years, His Holiness will make it very clear if he will come back. Could be born in Nepal, India, or even New York." In the monastery, the sound of young monks chanting Buddhist prayers rises into the sky even before the sun. The voices are coming from about 100 boys as young as 6, bent over books in a classroom with huge windows. At the first rays of dawn break over the mountains and reach into the room, the warm yellow light slides down the walls over a 4-foot-tall portrait of the Dalai Lama, and then bathes the young faces in gold. Memorizing these ancient prayers, including the one that can take an entire day to recite, will, quote, "stabilize your mind, make your memory stronger, and increase mindfulness," the headmaster says. They're praying for compassion, chanting in unison, "May I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings." Asked about embracing humanity everywhere in juxtaposition to this acrimony dividing people, the Dalai Lama pauses. "I think it is people who have power sometimes still thinking the 20th century's way of thinking whenever there are some difficulties and how to solve them by force," end quote. After almost 8 decades as Dalai Lama, he says human beings are, quote, "becoming more mature," end quote. He sees a much more hopeful world now, generally speaking, but suggests we begin to understand that we are all part of the oneness of 7 billion human beings in the world. He says that to make even a small contribution to the betterment of human beings has made him feel very, very happy. When asked about his contributions, he looks startled and chides, "It's wrong to think in terms of making a name for yourself. You should just focus on contributing for as long as you can." And he says, is there any part of him he wants to retire? "No, no, no, no," he says emphatically. "Every day is my prayer, determination, my body, my speech, my mind, dedicated to the well-being for the entire sentient beings, till my last breath, and even more. So long as space remains, so long as sentient beings' suffering remains, I will remain there in order to serve. That is my main prayer." Then he rises from his chair. There are more people waiting for audiences. The whispering monks are checking their watches, worried. Outside, the mountains have disappeared behind a heavy white mist by the time the Dalai Lama emerges. Still cheery, but moving a touch more slowly. It is starting to rain. A car is waiting to drive him back up the hill to his private quarters. He waves a goodbye. It's time to rest before he will rise again to help dispel the misery of humankind. That's the end of our program. Thank you for listening.